I look at
a lot of, I guess, sort of like the musical inspiration behind Bruno Mars and like his influences. Yeah. And like, just kind of like that era of music with such a, like, I know that like life was not idyllic or even perfect or even better than life today.
Right.
But I feel like there is a certain like, I don't know if it's like
fun.
Trying to find fun? What it is.
You're having it's
just,
fun.
It's just, there's a fun. There's it's fun, right? Yeah. Like, it's like I look at like old media and just like old music. It just seems like such a like fun, creative. Like people were just like just out here, just living, just having fun. And I feel like the fun and also just too. There's like this era of like people just being open with their emotions. Like I feel like nowadays it's very like you ain't gonna catch me slipping, nigga. Like da, 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 like giving all that. And I'm just like it's nice to like kind of be in an era where people are like, yes, I like really fuck with you, and I'm like not afraid of saying that. Like I like I'm gonna like allow myself the full breadth of my emotions, and also we're just gonna like have fun and just like dance together and just like be lit. And it just sounds
it's not that serious.
Fun. It just sounds so fun.
Ugh. It's not that serious. But I mean, I think that was right before the decline of the American Empire, right?
Yeah, true. So,
there's that.
Well, I guess we should.
I guess we'll start the show now.
Guess we should start.
Starting.
Oh my gosh! Damn. Oof,
it's like a whole other show. Okay. In the middle of the show. Okay. Starting in the listeners are going to be like, "Did we? Did you guys start, or are we jumping in the middle? You're jumping in the middle,
right?" Truly jumping in the middle.
Oh my god! Start. Okay. Starting in 3, 2, 1.
Hi, I'm Marcy.
And I'm Akko.
Yes, and welcome to the Colored Pages Book Club, a bi-weekly podcast that focuses on fiction, fantasy, and magical realism written by writers from colorful backgrounds.
Yeah, colorful backgrounds. And welcome back to the Summer Short Series. That's right. That is when, in the summer, or at least in the Western Hemisphere, the Upper Hemisphere, here we go, at least in the U.S., which we live, we switch it up and we read really whatever we want.
Yeah, literally, truly whatever we want, because today, y'all, it's not even fiction. We're not even given fiction, fantasy, or magical realism. This week, we're actually going to be reading our first ever memoir in the style of comics, which is called Persepolis by Marjane Satrapi.
Mm-hmm. I love it. It's like, you know, when you're taking a test and they're like A, B, C, D, or none of the above? It's like fiction, fantasy, magical
realism.
It's
giving very that. It's D, none of the above.
But it still plays with the genre as a comic memoir, which is a little bit like, you know, not what people were expecting. So... Mm-hmm. Yes, just to give a little background about Marjane Satrapi. Well, you're about to learn a lot about her because it's a memoir, but she became...
They're like, do we actually need this part? It's like, yes, are you... You do.
Just for a little context because, you know, you're going to read the book, but then this is how the book came into the popular consciousness. So she became famous worldwide for her autobiographical graphic novels, which was originally published in French in 4 parts from 2000 to 2003. And then it was translated into English into 2 parts. So there's Persepolis and then there's Persepolis 2. We read Persepolis 1. Well, we... Marcy read both because I forgot to tell them. I have read... I'm also cheating a little bit because usually on the podcast, we haven't read the books before. I did read Persepolis and Persepolis 2 when I was younger. But... I think as now that I'm older, I've come to it with a much different perspective and a lot more knowledge. Anyway, in the 2 books, she describes her childhood in Iran and her adolescence in Europe. She's won multiple awards for her work. But aside from that, one of the things she said that was really cool that stuck with me is that she detests the term graphic novel. And she says it's because people use it to shy away from the childishness or the unrefined connotation of comics. That's a paraphrasing. But she likes the term comic. And I think that's true. I think people, especially when in college when I read this, people were like, it's the era of graphic novels, you know? And they would cite all these, like, it was different. It wasn't Batman. It wasn't Black Panther. It was graphic novels. And I remember I was so annoyed because in high school, I wanted to do a criticism analysis of Calvin and Hobbes, which I think has a lot of themes of surrealism and absurdity and like nihilism. And it deals with a lot of, nihilism is a strong word, but yeah, a lot of life things stuffed into this like comic about a kid and his pet, it's not a pet tiger, it's a stuffed tiger. It's a, but my teacher was like, there's nothing to do a literary criticism of a comic. And then I went to college and they're like, well, not a comic, but a graphic novel certainly does have literary merit. And I was like, graphic novels are just comics. So to hear her say, and then in fact, I went to a talk about Persepolis, which the person said this exact, they were like, it's a graphic novel. It's different from Batman or something like that. So to hear her be like, no, actually, it's a comic. It is a comic, yes. And comics are deep. And it's true. And all those Marvel and Batman DC, I keep saying Batman, Marvel and DC comics are really deep. A lot of the storylines are really nuanced and interesting. And the same thing goes with manga and anime. Like these things that are pop culture, and a lot of times more like now comics and anime are big, but especially like the early 2000s and earlier, they weren't. And people could tell really innovative and analytical stories in them and kind of get away with it because they weren't pop culture, and so no one was really, you know, not regulating it, but yeah, no one had a watchful eye on it anyway. So I just really liked her saying that statement. I thought it also made me think, I was like, ah, she's a nerd like me. Yeah.
this is really interesting because y'all might be like, wow, like Marcy's fake as fuck, but honestly, like, I never fully what I'm about to say, I'm like, wait, that actually might be a really strong reaction. So like, I've never fully understood the difference. Like when people were like, oh, comics versus graphic novels, like I just kind of use them interchangeably because I mean, I feel like unless of course it's like, okay, like if you're talking about like the differentiation being like, okay, like, you know, if you're telling like in a graphic novel, it's assumed that it's following sort of like a story arc. Whereas like, I guess with a comic, you could have like a comic strip that's more of a like, almost like almost like an anthology. I was trying to find like the adjective version of that. I was like, girl, I don't know. But yeah, like kind of like an anthology or like really short. Like it's like, okay, like there's only a couple of panels. It's like a really quick thing.
And you're
I guess maybe that's how I differentiated it. But ultimately, I'm like, I mean, aren't they the same? Like, I mean, literally, it's just like it's pictures and words. Like, I don't like, aren't they the same? Like, it's just like, what the fuck is that? And like this whole like, oh, like comics, absolutely not. But graphic novels have a literary merit. It's like, why are we sitting here gatekeeping the mode of storytelling and acting as if like stories can't be told through all types of mediums? Like,
right.
You know what I mean? Like, it's like, what are we like? What, like, who the fuck cares? Like, honestly, like, if it tells a good story, it tells a good story.
It,
like, get the fuck over it.
Exactly. Well, you know, there's like a regality about literature, but also, to be fair, there is a slight distinction in that I would say it's comics subcategory graphic novels, right? Because you can have like serial comics. And then I know everyone who's born after 2000 is going to be like, what are you talking about? But in the newspaper, we used to have comics. Everyone's like, how much older are you than someone who's born in 2000? I'm like, don't question me. But in the in the newspaper, right, you had like serial comics where you had like weekly strips, or then like you had like Kathy or Family Circle. I guess Family Circle is the best example, where it was just like nothing ever happened in Family Circle or Marmaduke, right? Like there was no consistent storyline. Like it was just a one shot, not even a one shot, it was just a one panel. Like Marmaduke is sad, give him a treat. That's the end of the
story. Is Marmaduke an animal?
Marmaduke is a dog. Yes, I should have explained.
Okay, let me Google.
But
keep going.
But yeah, but usually, so comics have encompasses all of that, right? It encompasses the Sunday funnies, like the, and those anthology, like a Garfield strip, you know, a comic strip. It encompasses, you know, a superhero, whatever story, Marvel, DC, all the other ones, Image comics. Oh, let me throw out one that's not the two big ones. Anyway, so, but the point is, I do think a graphic novel tends to follow a more, it tends to be one or two books, not a bunch of, it's not a series. And it tends to have, yes, like a complete one story, right? With pictures. So I think that's the distinction people are making. But because it falls more similarly into the realm of a book, right? A literature book, people tend to take it more seriously. And then people tend to write graphic novels that are more serious. Like, that's the mode of a more serious comic. But no one ever calls, like, a collection. This is a gray area. Because there are, like, superhero comics that people would consider graphic novels. I'm thinking Watchmen is a really good example. Or V for Vendetta. Mm-hmm. But those are comics, right? And that's her point. Like, these are just comics. Like, yeah, the category of comics can encompass a lot of things. Well, they're still comics, and it doesn't delegitimize it in any capacity. By the way, that's
true.
Not the point of this episode. So, getting back to the point.
Also, real quick, before we pivot, I just looked up Marmaduke, and this dog is big as fuck. Was that like the gag? Like, Marmaduke is like enormous?
I don't know if it was the gag. I think it was just, to be honest, Marcy, I do not know what the gag of Marmaduke is.
Marmaduke is so big. This motherfucker is matching people by height. I'm seeing a picture of like a child walking Marmaduke, and Marmaduke is like three times as tall as this child. This is Marmaduke is walking himself. Like, this is wild.
Marmaduke's actually a dinosaur. Marmaduke is actually in like a post-apocalyptic future. Anyway, that's not.
Let's move on.
Someone's gonna put in the comics like they're gonna be like a deep dive into like the politics of Marmaduke. Speaking about a deep dive into something, I have a cultural context.
Oh shit.
Okay. I know. Here cool. we are. So we're gonna take a hard left away from comics into the history of Iran, if you guys are ready for it. And the reason for that is because
and Marmaduke. Oh my gosh.
But the reason for that is because the subject matter of Marjane Satrapi's book is her childhood in Iran during the Islamic Revolution, also known as the Iranian Revolution. So just to give some cultural context, because there's a lot of history here, she explains it very well in the story, but I was like, you know me, Akko's here with her footnotes. So here we go. The title of this book, Persepolis, is a reference to the great capital city of Persepolis, which was created around 518 BCE. By the way, BCE stands for before the Common Era. And then ACE is after the Common Era. And it's to move away from the idea of BC, which is before Christ, and after AD, which is after death, which is like a Christian metric of time measurement. It's kind of a band-aid on a problem because they refer to the same time periods. They didn't change time in any capacity. They just changed the word. Anyway, so Persepolis that's a side note for another time. And there's also other metrics of time, as we all know. But Persepolis was built by Darius the Great during the Persian Empire, one of the first Persian empires. Actually, it was the first, the Achaemenid Empire. And that empire was founded by Cyrus the Great. And it was a global hub of culture, religion, science, art, and technology for over 200 years. So at its height, under Darius the Great, the empire stretched from the European Balkan Peninsula, which is present-day like Bulgaria, Romania, and Ukraine, past into India and south into Egypt. It established regular trade between Asia and Africa. I know, it was huge. It's known as one of the first superpowers.
Oh my god, damn. Oh my
yeah, god, like it was very big. It established trade between Asia and Africa and Europe, and it built extensive roads and established the first postal service. So this first empire declined after a series of wars under one of the rulers, and then it was overtaken by Alexander the Great, which is a whole, again, just like I said with the Praveen episode, a whole another story about Alexander the Great, although I think people are far more aware of of him. But that's not the end, by the way, of the oldest and one of the longest existing empires in history. So after Alexander the Great, it was the Seleucid Empire, which was from 312 BCE to 248 BCE. That was followed by the Parthia Empire, which people, when they're usually talking about like the Romans and the Persians fighting, they're usually referring to this empire, which was not always, but which was between 248 BCE to 224 ACE. So now we skipped, right? Because if you talk about biblically, right, Christ was born in the Roman Empire. So when he died in the Roman Empire, right? So that's the Parthian Empire and the Roman Empire, biblical empire, are contemporaries. Okay, so then after that, you get the Sassanid Empire, and that lasted from 22 ACE until 655 ACE. And it ended with the Islamic invasion of Persia, which Marjane talks about in this book slightly. She references it. So she references the year 651. So that conquest led to the spread of Islam and the decline of the Zoroastrian religion. And of course, the Persian Empire we talked about this during the Praveen episode, right? Iran and the Persian Empire, by extension, were Zoroastrian, which is one of the oldest monolithic religions. And they had that up until this point in 655. So also, this is the time of the rise of the Islamic Empire and the Caliphate. So in 651, By the way, I know I'm running through these eras. These eras are like 200 to 300 years long. America is only like 300 years old, just so we're clear about the extent. And each one of them has like cultural hubs and advancements and knowledge and infighting and political intrigue. Like all of them have their own cultural basis and like strong influences on the world. But if we were to get into all of it, we'd be here for 10 years. So, right. So that was the decline of the Zoroastrian religion, and it caused a lot of people to flee, and it likely might have been one of like Praveen's family fleeing to move to India. This could be like it is possible when she talks about her ancestors leaving. This could be one of the times or after this point where people would have left to continue to like practice the religion. But people still practice Zoroastrian in Iran afterwards. But anyway, that's the point. So quickly moving forward, there's the Mongol invasion in 1219, and similar to Alexander the Great, every single person in the world was affected by the Mongol. Oh, like that's not the not the Americas, but Europe and Asia, not Africa. The Americas and Africa was and sub-Saharan Africa was fine from the Mongols, but everybody else in the world was really affected by them.
They're like, fuck.
Truly everybody. That, again, like I said, very interesting. People should read about it. And then in 1501 to 1736, that was the Safavid Empire, which established the 12th school of Shia Islam. And this is important because in America, especially when we were younger, the Iraqi-Irani conflicts, or any ones that we were told about, were framed as a fight between Sunni and Shia religions. And that was the only difference. And I think that's a simplification that's not just misleading, but actually just wrong, right? Because if you look at it, the Safavid Empire starts in 1501. We're talking about an empire that started in 518 BCE. So it's kind of a simplification to say that. And the invasion between Iraq and Iran started in 651, right? So to say that the conflict between them is because of a Sunni Shia fight of Islamic religion that's younger than the empire itself is a bit. It's very misleading. Anyway, so the contemporaries to the Safavid Empire, by the way, were the Ottoman Empire, which is modern-day Turkey, and the Mughal Empire, which is modern-day India, which we also talked about in the Praveen episode. But now we're getting a little bit closer to the present, which is good, right? People have heard of the Ottoman Empire and the Mughal Empire. Mm-hmm. So then the Safavid Empire was followed. And by the way, that was like a strongly Islamic empire. And so that's going to become relevant with the Iranian Revolution.
Sorry, which one was a strongly
the Safavid
Islamic empire?
The Safavid Empire.
Okay, gotcha. Okay.
And so is the next one, the Qajar Empire. After the Islamic invasion of 651, Islam slowly becomes pretty central to Iran. So it's not to say that Islam isn't very strong in Iran. It is. But it's not the first religion. It's not the oldest. And it's not the only, is what I'm trying to express. Mm-hmm. So after the Safavid Empire, that was followed by the Qajar dynasty. And that's actually Marjane's grandfather. That's the dynasty he was the prince of, the Qajar dynasty. That was from 1789 to 1925. And that dynasty ended when Reza Khan, the commander of part of the Persian army, staged a coup backed by the British. And here's where we get into British colonial history. I know everyone's like, every time you guys read a book, somewhere along the lines, the British show up. Yeah. The British are the question. They're like the equivalent of the Mongols.
Wasn't it the British and the U.S. that staged that coup?
Yeah, because the CIA was involved. But the reason, and now we're getting it. So the reason that they staged the coup was because of the British Industrial Revolution and the increased importance of oil. So Iran and Iraq became, there's like a whole thing. There's a book, it's called, I can't remember what it's called. Maybe it's called The Seven Sisters. And it talks about just the British, and you're right, the West, like they're basically playing games in the Middle East on some oil. Fuddy-duddy nonsense. So they back Reza Khan, who does a coup, and he effectively becomes the ruler of Iran. During that time, I think in 1935, the government asks everyone globally and in the country to call Persia Iran instead of Persia, which is not necessarily a bad thing because in Persian, also known as Farsi, it's referred to as Iran. Yeah, some derivative of the word Iran. So, but in the Persia word is like a little, it comes from part of the empire. I'm not entirely clear on it, but it recently you can use both. So you can say Iran or Persia. And a lot of people now say Persia because they want to claim an older dynasty before what I'm about to talk about happened. And that's honestly kind of why she's referring to the word, she calls the book Persepolis instead of, say, Safavid. You know, like she could have chosen any word, but she chose one of the first Persian Empire. So you'll see a lot of the Persian diaspora will say they're Persian. Anyway, that's just a footnote in a footnote. But from 1925 to 1979, the Shah, who was obviously sympathetic to the British, ruled Iran, and the U.S. ruled Iran. And you see Iran become very, very westernized. Like 1960s Iran looks like 1960s America and Britain. Like literally the same thing. Like it could have been, they're just, they look the same. You should look up pictures. They're online. So, however, people were not happy with the Shah for various reasons. And protests against him had both secular and religious elements. So also just for some more cultural context, right, it's the 20th century. So people are grappling with post-colonial era, the rule of the proletariat under like the communist philosophy, right? And what it means to have people actually rule instead of being like this consistent empire of imperialism and invasion and conquest, right? And they talk about in this book, like Iran has been part, you know, we just went through it. We got Alexander the Great. We got the Mongols. I mean, Jesus, like, the invasions are consistent. And in which with each of those invasions, right, there's war and there's death. And the people who suffer the most are the proletariat. So the idea of communism in a world for the people, you know, a country for the people, is a very strong feeling. So, and with all that context, and on the religious side, people start to miss the golden era, right? Which they're usually referring to the Safavid Empire, the Islamic era of the Iranian empire. So the Persian Empire. Mm-hmm. So you have those two pieces of this revolution coming together. And what really triggered the revolution was the burning of the Rex cinema by the Shah, in which 420 people were killed, which she talks about in this book as well. And the government tried to blame Islamic Marxists and Islamic militants for starting the fire, but everyone was like, no, we're pretty sure it was the government. We're all pretty
sure y'all asses did this.
Yeah. However, so everyone was really, you know, happy to protest against the government, and people were really happy when the Shah fell, because they were like, oh, now we have an era of freedom, you know, now we have you know, the proletariat and we the past glories of who we used to be, you know. However, the post-Islamic revolution had a lot of difficulties for people, and while people protested for both religious and secular reasons, the government became very conservative, which Marjane talks about in the book as well. And a lot of communist revolutionaries who were released after the fall of the Shah were captured or murdered again. And then, so things, and Marjane talks about this too, like the schools became separated by gender, and there was just a lot more restrictions. And was that mostly because of actual Islam, or was it because you could use the ideology to change your social status? We don't know. Marjane talks about that as well. But after that, I know you're like, wait, there's an after? Yes. Because simultaneously or contemporaneously, the Iraq-Iran war started in 1980. That's right. Revolution, 1979. War, 1980. And that didn't end until 1988. And it ended as a stalemate. It's likely that the Iraqi government thought it could take advantage of the time with Iran being in upheaval to start a revolution. But the war in a lot of ways sustained the new government, because it gave them a common enemy and a justification for stricter policing and ruling, right? And like, think about the way we talked about how violence stops the nuance of things. Like, if you're in such fear of bombings, which they talk about in this book and all this stuff, you know, there's not a lot. It's you solidify power in an empire, because there's so much fear, and there's so much less space for nuance, and so many people flee,
right?
So understandably flee, like, yeah. So that is, and by the way, again, just to state, I am not Iranian. I'm not part of the Iranian diaspora. So anything I said that was incorrect, any person who corrects me, completely open to it, have absolutely no reason to say anything else. And again, this is a simplification, a complete simplification. There is so much beauty and depth and wonderfulness and also complexity and, you know, and violence and such. But there's so much more to the story than the summary I'm giving. And like I said, each one of these empires is like 200 years. So mm-hmm. I highly, highly, and Iraq, the Iraqi-Iranian conflict, also a simplification. We didn't even get into the Islamic Golden Age and how like Iran and Iraq like were in, during that time or any of that stuff, and which is all deeply interesting. And you should read a book about it. But I do hope that giving this like cultural context makes people want to read more about these things and to understand this comic a little better. Yeah.
Hmm. Well, thank you. Thank you for that. So reading this, I mean, yeah, a lot of the latter half of what you talked about, I was like, okay, yeah. Like they talked about this in Persepolis. but before I was like, yeah, like the, like BCE shit, I was like, yeah, I didn't know a lot of this, shit. So, this is definitely helpful to hear. Thank you so much. Yeah. So let's take a little bit of a break and when we get back, we'll talk about, just summary of, I guess Persepolis 1, if we're being specific.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So see y'all in a bit.
Woo.
We are.
Yeah.
Yes.
So thank you for that rendezvous to history class with Akko.
We love it. I was in the front row taking notes. You know, people was trying to pass notes to me in class. And I was like, girl, I'm listening to Akko lecture. Like, how dare you? Like, I'm actually trying to pay attention. Like, girl, get the fuck. Also, who passes notes anymore? Like, we have cell phones.
I was about
anyway.
To say, I was like, are we T9 in class? Where you're like, and then young kids are like, we're not even doing that. We're literally just posting on Instagram. And you're like, our bad. Sorry, we're old.
You remember when you had to like press like, so yep. I actually didn't like T9 work. I felt
awful.
Like it was inaccurate. And it would like, it would incorrectly try to predict what I was trying to say. Mm-hmm. So I would just manually text. And like, it would be the worst when you would like try to type like, for example, like a C. So you're pressing the number 2 like 3 mm-hmm. times, but then you accidentally hit it a 4th. Then it becomes like a comma or some shit. And you're like, girl, are you fucking serious? You have to go through all of that shit. And then you have to like go to like
erase
A,
it.
B, go back to C. Oh my God. And the worst is like, if you were saying a word like call me or something, it's like you have to like press like 3 times to get to C. Mm-hmm. Wait.
Yes, to get to the next letter. Yes. The kids don't even know. They don't
quickly,
even know.
Then it would just go into the next character, and you're like, fuck!
Yes!
Anyway.
So then you have like, oh my God, I can't even. And then the kids are like, what are you talking? And they're, yeah, like different numbers were associated with letters, y'all. I know. And then some kids are like, yeah. Don't talk down to us. We know what T9 is. So anyway, this book is a comic memoir by Marjane Satrapi, as we said. It's about her childhood. And the backdrop is the Iranian Revolution, also known as the Islamic Revolution, which occurred from 1978 to 1979 to overthrow the Shah and establish an Islamic Republic. And then, of course, the subsequent the beginning of the Iraq-Iran War, which happened in 1980. So Marjane was born in 1969. So she is 10 years old when the revolution occurs. So obviously the story is from her perspective as a 10-year-old. And she actually, because as we stated earlier, her grandfather on her mother's side was a prince during the Qajar Empire, which came right before the Shah in 1925. They actually have a bit of social power and wealth and class, even though they're no longer royalty. In the book, she refers to herself and everyone refers to her as Margie. And she attends a secular bilingual French school. And after the revolution, it actually becomes separated by gender. And as we said, you know, in the cultural context, the government's more conservative. So the girls are required to wear veils. Now, her parents are participated in the revolution against the Shah. And I mean, there's obviously personal reasons as her maternal grandfather was overthrown, but also the ideas of, you know, communism and fairness, which they also talk about. And so Margie is curious to learn more about those things. So she starts reading about Che Guevara and Fidel Castro, Leon Trotsky, Karl Marx, all of which are communist thought leaders and revolutionaries, in case anyone was like not up on their communism history. So after her grandfather actually was dethroned, he started to kind of learned more about communism and like slowly became a communist and was like, why are we oppressing the proletariat? So Marx, right? I know, what a change. third change in the third act. So Margie talks to her grandmother to learn more about her grandfather and what he went through. And it's interesting because her grandmother is kind of, and there's, you see this divide in the story a lot, where Margie has such a reverence and this beauty for heroes and revolutionaries, but they're also very personal and close to her, and they're kind of just dealing with their human everyday lives. And that, that juxtaposition is really strong and really well done in this book. But anyway, so Margie also has to come to terms with the fact that she's upper class, even though she's saying all this like the communist revolution, she's upper class. And Mehri, who works in their house and takes care of her, does not have the same social status. And there's this whole side story where Mehri's writing to this boy next door and she's like in love with him, and she doesn't know how to write. So Margie's writing the letters for her as a 10-year-old. And then finally the word gets around that Mehri's in love with the neighbor. And so everyone tells each other. And finally Margie's father goes over to him and is like, hey, just so you know, that's not, her status is not the status you think. Do you still want to marry her? And the guy gives over the letters that she's been writing and just like wants nothing to do with it anymore, which is like, wow. But then obviously Margie's parents are like, why were you writing this is your handwriting. And Margie's like, what? I don't want things to be different in social class. And so that's one of the first moments where Margie has to kind of reconcile those two things. So after the
which is like real quick, which is such an interesting moment, because I was like, her parents were like all about like the revolution, though. That part kind of threw me off a little bit, because I was like, wait, aren't y'all always talking about the like,
so I don't
proletariat
think,
and shit, like, I don't know. That moment kind of confusing, I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah, well, I don't think her parents were saying she can't marry him. I don't think that her parents had a problem with Mehri dating this guy. I don't think they cared, but they were like, in the society we live in, people are gonna have a problem with this, so he needs to know what is actually happening, because it's not fair to Mehri. Like, his feelings aren't that strong. Like, he actually doesn't care about her. Like, he just cares about the status, and he doesn't want to go against the social status. And so it's like, this person's going to be even more heartbroken if they get even further. And then, like, they actually meet, and he's like, actually, no. Like,
right.
So I guess what I'm saying is the social context does matter. Like, if you're gonna buck the rules, of course everyone buck the fucking rules, but you have to know what they are. And I think that's what happened. He was like, it's about to cause a problem, but it's still sad, right? It's incredibly sad. And like, Margie has to reconcile the fact that no, a lot of your life choices are decided by your social status in a lot of places, including America, and how people love and the relationships they're willing to get into are based on that too, including America. Yeah, we don't think about it because it's not as prevalent, but yeah, think about that. There are a lot of divides that we don't discuss. Maybe no one says, in fact, honestly, in America, you just don't say the quiet part out loud. Here, all they did was say the quiet part out loud. So anyway.
I know, that's right. Yeah.
After the revolution, some of the family friends who were revolutionaries and protesters come back to visit. And their names are Siamak and Mohsen. And they have these like really cute stories, but it's not cute because they're being tortured. But the way it's written, they're like, it's a very familial setting. And Siamak and Mohsen haven't seen each other. Well, they've seen each other in jail. Margie's father has not seen them. And so they're like, kind of, they have a bond between the two of them. But it's sad because they're telling these really depressing stories where they're like tortured. And one of their friends who was like a very adamant revolutionary was killed. And they also talk about the CIA taught them, like the guards, how to torture more effectively. So then it's, yeah. And then they also, and I think Cymax's daughter is Margie's age. And Margie, of course, is popping off on the mouth saying things that don't make any sense because she's 10. And the friend was like, so, but that's kind of Margie's whole personality. But so then we also meet Margie's uncle, Anoush, who along with his uncle proclaimed the independence of the Iranian province of Azerbaijan, which right now is its own country, as everybody knows, or if you don't know, you know now. But his uncle was later captured by the state, but Anoush fled to Russia before he came back, and then he was arrested for 9 years. But he was also let out. So around this time, Margie's friends are starting to flee the country because a lot of people, especially of her class status, right, are afraid of what what's going to happen after this revolution, right? It's partially a communist revolution. It's partially an Islamic revolution. It's kind of, it's starting to become less and less of a communist revolution, as you'll see in a second.
Yeah.
it's about to be a wholly not a communist revolution.
Right.
And so a lot of people are fleeing because they're afraid of the upheaval that's happening. And in times of war, let's be real, people flee. It's the government upheaval is terrifying. So then, as we said, the new government starts to become more conservative. It's trying to hold on to power, and it starts killing the secular side of the revolution. So Saimak and Mohsen, who we literally talked about like two lines ago, Mohsen is murdered, and then Saimak is almost murdered, but they miss him when they go to his house, the government guards, and they end up killing his sister. So he and his wife and the girl that's Margie's contemporary flees as well with her family.
So I guess just like picking up. So around that same time, so Margie's uncle Anoush is also taken, and asked to specifically see Margie, like during I guess like his last visit. Margie at the time didn't know that this would be like her last visit with him, slash just her last time seeing her uncle, just in general. But yeah, like during the exchange, like, so, okay, so Margie and her uncle actually had this really cute thing where, like, they would just, the way I read it was like, they would just, like, you know, be chatting about whatever. Margie, just, so for context, she's very, she's like very precocious. She's very, she like speaks her mind. She's very, like, confident, like, just very much someone who, like, isn't afraid of, like, you know, just like expressing her opinion and, like, just, you know, like, getting into grown folks' business, basically. Like, adults will be talking. She's like, oh, Margie, like, Margie will literally be, like, perched at the table, listening, contributing. They're like, girl, you were like 10 years old. She's like commenting on like communist revolutionaries and shit. Anyway, so basically they had this dynamic where like, you know, they would like Anoush and Margie would have these conversations. And I feel like whenever there was like a lull in the conversation, like Anoush would be like, here, take this bread swan that I made. Like I like turn this bread into like a piece of swan. Or piece of bread into a swan. I'm going to like give it to you, Margie. Enjoy this. You're a child. So like it's that's pretty really much what happens the last time she sees him. Like, you know, they have this great conversation and he gives her like a bread swan, and unfortunately that was actually the last time, you know, she saw him because he was later executed.
So, and I think he says, he's like, this bread swan is the uncle of the last bread swan I gave you. So like the last one's him, the first one was her, and the second one is him.
It was just very sweet. So around this time, you know, the country is becoming like increasingly like religiously conservative, but like more so in the way that it's like they're trying to just really like squash dissent and like have people like, I guess, prove their loyalty to this like current regime.
Yeah.
You also see around this time that like people who are like very much sort of like, I guess, like loyalists to the current regime, like sort of are able to access power in a way that they weren't before the revolution and everything.
There's definitely...
So just like a lot of like...
I was going to say, just to your point, Marcy, there's a lot of like change in social status, right? Like, I think there's one point where someone says like, oh, that person used to wash my windows and now he's a government, like, I don't know, government something. Akko clearly does not work in the government. Now he's a government something. But yeah, exactly. Like a loyal, there's an access to power by being more loyal and therefore by extension more, or at least appearing, if not really being, appearing to be religiously conservative.
Right. Exactly. So it's just like a lot of shifting social dynamics. Also, like Akko mentioned earlier, around this time, the war between Iraq and Iran begins. And from Margie's perspective, we kind of are seeing how a lot of... So for context, Margie and her family live in Tehran, which is the capital. But a lot of the border towns, I guess, between like Iraq and Iran are like being bombed. They're sort of like the initial sites of like a lot of the violence. And so around this time, you also see that like Margie, you know, Margie's like family friends who like kind of live in those areas are like kind of coming to Tehran to like, you know, just spend time there. And for a lot of people, I know there was one family friend who like apparently was like hella rich, like had like the bag was secure and then pretty much, just like everything was destroyed. And like, you know, it was this interesting moment where like, you know, naturally he was kind of lamenting, you know, like all the things that he had lost. But like also Margie's dad was like, girl, I mean, you're alive though.
Yeah.
You have a place to stay.
But also, Margie's dad's house is still there.
Exactly. And it's interesting too, because around this time, there's also just a lot of like ire against this idea of like Western decadence and this sort of like this over materialist kind of, just like Western obsession with like just like wealth and like the just being really like decadent and showy and all of that. And so like again, there's just a lot of like kind of cultural clashes, a lot of like these different sort of dynamics at play. Margie, meanwhile, is just like, okay, I'm just gonna live my life, keep going to school, whatever.
Be a child.
She did go to like a bilingual French school, but they stopped. So I'm not sure if like this, I want to say the school itself still existed, but like they just stopped the like French
part. I think so.
Like they were like, oh, we're not doing this French shit anymore, girl. It's like, fuck all this Western nonsense. And so at school, like kind of like Akko mentioned, you know, they start to like separate girls and boys. Like in Margie's classes, like, you know, the girls are expected to do things like, you know, knitting like winter hoods for like, you know, Iranian soldiers who are like part of the war. So just like kind of a lot going on. Also, too, around this time, we hear some like interesting. So Margie, for context, you know, does come from a lot of privilege. And so like while she's kind of just like at school, like doing these different things, she's still allowed to like kind of just be at school and like live her life. There's like a lot of like mischief, like people talking back to their teachers.
Yeah.
Like,
she skips school. She skips school and goes to like the more, there's like a little section of town that's still Western and she's hanging out with her friends, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So very much giving that. But meanwhile, so a family friend of Margie's mother was saying that like at the school, like the teachers there had given her son like a key. And basically the key was a symbol of like a key into paradise, basically. So it's like if you give your life to this war, like you take this key and like this will essentially assure you like a good sort of afterlife experience, like, you know, yeah, afterlife experience, kind of calling to just like have this class kind of give their lives for this war and like really kind of romanticizing that ideal.
Exactly, making it almost like not just like holy to do it. It's kind of like there's a poem. It's called "Dulce Est Decorum Esque," and it's about I think it's French. It's about World War I, and it's a poem that's in mockery because at the beginning of World War I, for a lot of young people, they said it was sweet and beautiful to die for the cause.
Right.
And that it's a similar thing here. The reason I'm paralleling it with Europe is because I don't want people there is a stereotype about like. I'm not even going to go into it.
I know exactly what you're saying.
But there is a stereotype about these wars and a religious fervor around it that is not that people make like it's something different from any other war that's been fought or any other propaganda or any other use of power and call to patriotism and nationalism. So that's the reason I'm making the parallel so that people understand that like they're using like religion and text, but it's not. It's not accurate, right? And even this mother who talks to Margie's mother about it is super upset because she's like, I don't know why they would give my 13-year-old son a key and tell him this like baseless lie to have him fight a war from the an indoctrination. Anyway, Marcy, continue.
Right. Absolutely. Vary that. And yeah, and like another one of Margie's mom's cousins who was actually in the military but had come home for leave kind of confirmed the same thing that yes, like a lot of not only... Yeah, like these young boys, like, you know, like Margie's age, essentially, like early adolescence onward, are like kind of just being thrown into this war and like are on the front lines and are dying like critically from all of this. And so like, obviously, like, you know, he's pretty against it. And he's like, what the fuck is going on? Also worth saying, too, that like a lot of the communities that these boys are coming from are from like these like kind of lower income communities where it's like people are kind of seen as more disposable. And so like you don't see, for example, the boys who go to school in the area that Margie lives, like they're talking about shit like this. Like it's very much like a specific kind of class targeted thing. So,
and in fact, I think Margie calls her cousin. I was just gonna say, I think Margie calls her cousin to ask if he's hearing the same stuff, and he was like, what are you talking about? So it's exactly what you're saying. A divide and how screwy is that, right? Because the whole point of this was the proletariat would finally be heard, and now you're very much not doing that.
Right. So just a lot of dynamics going on at play. Fast forward a little bit. So around as the war is progressing, we see that Tehran is like becoming more and more the site of bombings from Iraq. And so Margie kind of talks about how like it becomes just like normalized that like, for example, if you're just like living your life doing whatever, you'll hear the siren, and the siren's like an indicator of like, okay, girl, like, go ahead and hide or do something. So she and like her family just like run down into the basement along with like just other families that stayed in the same building. And like they would just kind of like wait it out as like, you know, the bombs were kind of like exploding overhead.
Yep.
Yeah, so that's all happening. She's like kind of describing that experience. And just more and more, like, the government's just becoming like more and more paranoid. Mm-hmm. And like, at this point, like, you just can't really trust people. Like, at one point, Margie's mom put up these like black curtains over their windows just so that like the neighbors wouldn't be able to like see inside to see what they're doing. Because technically, a lot of the shit that like Margie's family is doing is like not, like, you ain't really supposed to be doing shit like right. that. Like, you know, they're having parties, they're dancing, they're drinking alcohol.
They're having a fun
like, they're
time.
Honestly just like, yeah, they're just kind of doing like whatever you want. But like, if you were caught by the government doing these things, or if a neighbor reported you mm-hmm. for doing that shit, your ass would be taken and like, you know, any god only knows what would happen to you. So it's very much like, it's a show of rebellion, but also two people are like, I mean, I need to also live my life too. Like, mm-hmm. I'm gonna also like enjoy myself. I'm not gonna like let this, like, you know, this conflict between governments like limit my ability to kind of like, you know, enjoy my life and, you know, like really like honor these relationships around me and stuff like that. Another dual purpose of the black curtains is that if ever, for example, like windows are blown out from like explosions or things like that, the black curtains would kind of catch it so mm-hmm. that you don't have like a bunch of like glass debris like flying into the house and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Which is such a nuanced thing that I was like, I would have literally never thought of that. But we'll get into that.
But think about it, like, you only know about it because people would only know to do that from experience, right?
Exactly.
And it's, in particular, it's Margie's mom who says it. And Margie's mom, like, if you know, like, her family line has been, she says in the story, she's like, Iran has gone through a bunch of revolutions. She's like, my grandfather just said, like, duck your head and wait for the wave to pass. Like, she's there. It's not just her life, but it's almost like knowledge that's been passed down on to how to survive this. And I think you talk about it, you mentioned it. You haven't mentioned it yet, but you're going to. And sorry, I can read the notes, y'all. I'm sorry. But people are going to be like, is Akko a soother? No, it's in the notes. But you talk about how imagination is changed by these circumstances, right? And even humans are so adaptable that even our instincts change, you know?
Right.
I cut you off. Continue.
You're fine. No, you're totally fine. Thank you for that. Thank you for that. Yeah, and honestly, so where Persepolis 1 kind of wraps up is that, so around this time, you know, Margie's family is kind of just like, you know, doing what they gotta do to like kind of stay undercover but still like living their lives. Mind you, during this they have a lot of close calls. Mm-hmm. Like, oh my god, there was a scene where I think Margie's family, they had like gone to like someone else's house and they were like all drinking and partying and like whatever. They were on their way back, they got stopped by like these guards who were like, have y'all been drinking? Like, what the fuck? And like, you know, Margie's dad was like, oh, no, girl. Like, what you talk about? And the guards were like, okay, we're going to follow you and like go inside your house and see what's up and make sure that you're not doing anything that's like against, you know, this regime. And so they end up making this whole plan where like once they get to the house, like Margie and her grandmother are like somehow able to slip away. Like, oh, I think it was like they were trying to slip away to like get rid of all the alcohol inside. And then like the guards were like, where the fuck are y'all going? And then like the grandmother was like, oh, like, you know, I have diabetes. You know, I have to like kind of take care of it or whatever. And the guard was like, oh my god, like my mom had diabetes or something like that. So it was just like there was like some kind of like similarity there. He was like, okay, yeah, y'all can like go inside, do your thing, whatever. So of course, you know, Margie and her grandmother, they run inside to get rid of all the alcohol, and once the guards get inside, it was like fine.
No actually, and it was just what happens is Margie's dad pays him a bribe and the guy leaves. That's what happens. He doesn't even get inside.
Also that, yeah, so basically it's like a lot of close calls like that where like just because of like just circumstances or just the person that you caught up with like that day, like
mm-hmm.
it could really have a huge impact on what exactly is going to happen to you next. Like, you know, if someone is like willing to, you know, take a bribe or do whatever, like it's just like, you know, you have to like kind of, it's very precarious.
Yep.
So it's just like a lot. And then there was another situation where Margie's house almost got bombed, where like basically they were so around this time, so this is the piece I was going to mention earlier, like as the war progressed, like there were a lot more just like missile attacks. And so with the missile attacks, they were different because like, yes, you would still run into a basement if you heard the alarm, but honestly, if a missile hits your house, like no one's going to survive.
Yeah.
That like, it's not, you just kind of have to wait the 3 minutes and just see if anything happens to you. And
yes,
like that's like, you really just have to like kind of just sit and wait. Honestly, half the time they were like, girl, you might as well just like not even go downstairs because like it's just regardless, you're, we shall see. Mm-hmm. And there was one day where Margie was not home, but she like had heard that there was like a missile that had, like flown into her street, like the end of her street or whatever where she lived.
Yep.
And it was either like her house or like her neighbor's house across the street that got hit. But you know, but it was like her neighbor's house that got hit instead of hers. And her mom was like, you know, like Margie like showed up to the scene and like, you know, her mom was there or whatever. And like, her mom was trying to like walk her away from the situation. Was like, oh yeah, you know, the family, they were gone. You know, they weren't at home or whatever. But like Margie looks over and like,
She's a bracelet.
Clearly they were at home. You know, like, just like...
Well, she sees her friend's bracelet and she knows the bracelet because she's like, her grandmother gave it to her for her 14th birthday. And so she's pretty sure that they were home.
Yeah. So just a lot going on around this time, needless to say. You know, Margie's really struggling, like, at school. At this time, she's around, like, 13, and she's, like, very much, like, trying to exercise her own freedom. And she's, like, also super traumatized with what's going on and, like, really angry at the propaganda of, like, what's being taught in school, that, like, this is somehow justified or, like, needs to be happening. And so, like, Margie just very much, like, kind of talks back to everybody. And, like, her parents are like, yeah, Margie, honestly, girl, if you stay here, like, you might get killed because, like... the way you're moving through life right now and, like, just, like, the way you talk to these people, like, it's just not...
And I think...
It's not... It may not fare well for you...
Soon.
In the future, were we going to say?
Well, I think, too, and we didn't get into this because there's so much, but they're trying to get a passport for one of their friends to go see his son, who they sent to Austria for safety. And so they go to this guy who makes fake passports, and he's hiding an 18-year-old girl who's a communist or communist sympathizer. And while he's making the passports, they find that young girl. I'm not going to get into that story. There's a lot of violence, particularly against women in that story. And it freaks out Margie's mom, because she's like, you don't understand, like, that girl was just, she was just like a communist sympathizer, like, hiding, and they caught her and did terrible things to her and killed her. Like, she's very worried about her daughter, and especially her parents don't want to say, like, she can't be bold and strong, but like I said, violence destroys the nuance of things. Like, there is so little space to let her be who she is, because it's dangerous. Right. I'm sorry. So then, what Marcy is going to explain the end of, if Akka would stop interrupting. There you go.
No, you're fine. It's so around this is pretty much where Persepolis 1 ends, and basically you know, kind of what happens next. We won't really get into all the details, but essentially where the book kind of continues to sort of go into Margie's life is that she ends up actually moving to Austria for 4 years. So, like, it kind of details her experience in Austria, living in Europe, and then she eventually does come back to Iran for a number of years before, at the very end of the book, she moves to France. And so the book just kind of continues to, like, talk about her life, kind of like the cultural adjustments of being abroad and coming back and all of that. It's, like, really, really interesting, and there's, like, a lot going on. But for the sake of brevity, you know, summer shorts, we're just going to talk about that first piece. And that's what we're going to mainly kind of, like, have our discussion around. But highly encourage y'all to read the rest of this memoir, because it is incredible.
Yeah, it's super good.
So, yeah.
It's super good. But just so for clarity, Persepolis, the first one, ends with her parents sending her to Vienna by herself. So they don't come with her.
Yes.
For her safety. Yeah.
So, yes. So let's take a little bit of a break. And when we get back, we'll get into all of our thoughts and feelings, because they are just... there's just so much. See you on a bit.
Woo!
And we're back. So, yes. So, y'all, so as y'all can tell, this book is extremely different from what we typically read.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it. Like, I really, really loved this memoir. Honestly, reading this made me think, like, okay, I need to, like, read more memoirs. Because, frankly, I haven't really read that many throughout my life. And just, like, the way that the story is told is just really, really interesting.
Mm.
I love that, like, there's just so much nuance in the story. Where it's, like...
Yep.
At the base of it, you're just getting kind of, like, the day-to-day life of Margie, right? And, like, obviously, there's a lot... going on politically in the backdrop and all of that, but it's just kind of woven in so seamlessly into her life.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you're just kind of seeing how, like, she's just living. How, like, for example, you see, I remember at the very beginning of the book, you know, she was talking about how, like, you know, around, like, after the revolution, like, you know, at school, they had to, like, wear veils and stuff like that. And everyone was like, girl, what? And you kind of saw these different pictures of, like, how, like, I mean, again, she's, like, a child.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, kids are, like, playing with the veils and, like, doing all this other shit. And the teacher's like, girl, what are y'all doing? Like, it's not a game. Like, it's just, like, you're seeing, like, childhood, like, sort of, like, mischief and just, like, frivolity and, like, just the ability for people to still, like, just, like, yeah, like, just live their lives amidst so much shit going on. And it's not to say that like it's not it downplays anything or it downplays the seriousness of what's happening. You see a lot everything reflected tonally throughout this book, but like I just loved how nuanced of an experience it was, mm-hmm. and just how you just saw how precarious everything was.
Yes.
How like truly it was like a stroke of luck that like Margie was able to even later tell the story. I mean,
yeah.
there's things that happen in Persepolis too where it's like she made it out by honestly, it was just like she could have just as easily
not
have like been detained or been arrested or worse, you know what I mean? Like it's like so much shit could have happened, but like just because of like we're like, you know, just where she was at that time, the people she was interacting with, she was able to, you know, stay with her family and like kind of keep in touch, like, you know, have those close bonds around her and stuff. It's just really, really interesting. You just see how like when you live in a state of just constant precariousness where like something is just like nothing is guaranteed, how like, you know, at the sound of a siren, it's like a missile could be flying towards your house. And like, even if you're like running to the base, like there's just nothing you can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like you just are there. And what happens, happens. It's like you see what that does to people. You see what that does to people's like imaginations and their frameworks and just their behavior and like how people move in a situation like that. And how you really understand how, like, for example, like you could look at like Margie's family's behavior and be like, this, what are y'all doing, partying and drinking and just like living your lives knowing that this is dangerous. But also too, you could also kind of understand like, okay, well, girl, like, and then like,
what else are you supposed to do?
It's like, what else is there to do? Like, death could truly meet us today, so like,
also,
I'm gonna
like,
enjoy my life
more than that
while I'm here.
Right. But also just like, also literally not even in like an act of resilience or any, just what else, literally what else are you supposed
right.
to do with your life except for live it? And people forget
exactly.
that like in these times of political turmoil is still someone's whole life. Like Margie's not going to be 10 again. Her parents aren't going to be, you know, however age they are again. Like,
mm-hmm.
and the more precariousness it is, you almost like, yo, let's have fun because exactly, we might not get tomorrow. Like this might be the
exactly.
only time we're happy and we get to see each other. I think people,
exactly.
I think I think, and this was hard for me to understand when I was younger too, and from the privileges I've had, I couldn't understand. I remember I was talking to my dad about this once. I am West African and there are coups that have happened and they were telling me a story and I was like, what? I don't, mm-hmm. but then he would say something hilarious, like right in the middle. He'd be like, oh man.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just, like, I'm not going to get into it, but and I was like, that's really funny, but the context that you're telling it in is so miserable. And I remember talking to him one day and I was so upset and he was like, he, you know, in a very soothing voice, which is like, yeah, but that's, you know, but you live anyway, but you live, and that's what it is. You just have to live.
Yeah.
And I don't think a lot of us are, and some of us aren't, pushed to that edge where you have to reconcile that reality, that precariousness.
Right.
But this book, yeah. like, so deeply expresses that with a humor and like, a fullness, because it's her real life, you know.
Yeah.
She also writes it beautifully. I think you could have written your real life not as well as she did too. She's a very good writer and storyteller to
right.
portray the beauty and the nuance and the here we go, juxtaposition of these two like
the word was gonna come at some point. Here we are.
But these seemingly very different realities, and I think
mm-hmm.
and I think we understand a little bit more in a different context how with the pandemic, just how things can, and honestly with the last 4 years, just how things can be both simultaneously terrifying and hilarious. Like the mm-hmm. the most scary thing, but also completely banal and ridiculous.
Right.
And in some ways, that's where humor, this dark humor comes from, right? Is that life is absurd and not always, and it's almost like the flip of interpreters of Melodas. Like life is absurd.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that absurdity is violent and it hurts
yeah.
more. Like it's ridiculous and it hurts. Like
right.
Like the people who are in charge of this. When I was reading the Marcy, did I let you finish? I did not. Continue.
No, you're fine. I mean, the only other thing I was gonna say was just like, yeah, like what you're saying earlier about your dad is that like just that notion of like, just through all of it, just you just keep living, like you just keep living. Like that's just such a deeply human, deeply human response. And it's like, I think that sometimes, yeah, like you said, you know, we can kind of like romanticize, like, oh my God, like this is a show of rebellion or like resistance. And like, yeah, there's like space for that. Mm-hmm. But also sometimes it's just like, girl, I'm just trying to live. Like, I'm just not about to let y'all fuck up my whole life like on whatever like political shit is going on that I honestly have nothing to do with. Right. You know what I mean? Like, so, and I was going to say, and yeah, like and I love how like, it's just so casual. Like you kind of see it even later on in the book too, where it's like, you know, when Margie, especially when she comes back to Iran after being in Austria, like there are just all these like shows of like rebellion against what's going on, whether it be like women showing more of their hair underneath their veils, or like, you know, people like women wearing makeup, or you know, men like shaving and like kind of dressing a certain way. You know, you just see all of these like different things that showcase like, okay, like I'm just casually not with the shit. It's like I'm just not with the shit, and I'm honestly, girl, like I'm just gonna take the risk to like
anyway,
you know, just
I'm gonna take the risk anyway,
showcase that. And it's like, and I think it's one of those things where it's like, and obviously like, you know, that's a very particular narrative, and that's not the narrative of like everyone that was in there, so I don't want to you know, aggregate it in that sense. But I think you see kind of the casual ways in which people forge and force space for themselves in situations that like really like kind of like Akko usually mentions, how like when violence tries to remove the nuances of who we are, like people are like, but actually no, y'all got me fucked up, because actually no, I'm gonna still be a person, actually no, I'm still gonna like live, you know, an authentic life to the degree that I can, and push against all of these forces that try to like squash this in. And it's just really interesting, because it's like, you look at a regime like this, and it's like, there's no incentive really to like be count, like it's like when you look at it as far as like just all the risks that come along with being subversive or like going against the grain, like there's so many, and yet that happens all the time, and not even just specifically in this context, but just like throughout just world history. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And think about the Black American experience, like just to bring it back to America, like there are so, I'm sure, Marcy, I'm sure you've talked to people who have been through things and but still had a jovialness even about the time where this difficult thing happened, right? Like, and this sent, not to like, Akko tells Marcy like what happened in their family. Okay. But I'm right. It's, I just want people to understand that this story is the story of humans. It's a story of what people do in moments of oppression and darkness. And it is a testament to the human, not resilience, but the human. That's what I mean when I'm saying there's something about humans. There's something about us that's special, and that we will continue to be humans, like as much as possible for as long as possible. We will try to laugh. We will try and find beauty. We will try even in despair. And it's also very human to give in to despair, right? Like a lot of people are in despair in this book.
Right.
But even in the face of these mechanisms, we try so hard to be ourselves, which brings me to one of my points. When I was reading this book, I was like, what will be the point when the ways we choose to govern ourselves are the most in line with the human nature? And then not just the human nature, but the best of human nature, right? Like, because authoritarian rule on a group of people is not in line with human nature, and it is most likely to produce like rebellion that you will have to use violence to control, right? Which means it's innately not a good idea, right? Like,
it's just not working.
It's not working. and like, the reason I added the context of all the other imperialistic empires isn't to just be like there's been war for years, but also there has been war for years, and you wonder like at what point are humans going to evolve past this need to use these levels of violence for control and power, and at what point, because you read the book and you're like, why do you need to murder 420 people? Why do you need to invade? Why do you need to kill the communist sympathizers who partially helped you like have this revolution,
get into power,
right? Exactly. What's the point? What is the and that's where I know people are gonna be like, really, House of the Spirits? And that's where House of the Spirits does, I know, they're like that book,
throw back.
All the way back. I took the ball, I lobbed it all the way 100 yards back.
Come on, episode 5 and 6. Yes.
But that's where House of the Spirits kind of does explain the mentality of a dictator and how that affects all of us. Right. And when you got down to it, right, it wasn't the strongest person. It wasn't the person with the most ideals. It wasn't the person who felt the most for society or the most for the people. It was the person who felt the least, who was the most coddled, right, the most insecure, the most afraid of not having what they wanted. And at the core of violence is so much insecurity. But it causes so much harm. It causes, so many people are lost in this story. The story with Anoush, my heart broke. With the girl, the 18-year-old, yeah, broke again. With her friend who, yeah, lived next door. It's so painful for something. I think in Kingdom of Grace, Grace of Kings. I was about to say Kingdom of Souls. So many kingdoms. Also, all those are my books. I got kingdom books for days and I can't even keep them straight. But I think we talked about there's something special about life, you know, and people, mm-hmm, die for ideals, but there's something beautiful about living. And that's what I meant, I think. And while ideals are so important, people have done beautiful things on ideals. Humans are so valuable, and I don't know why we continue to undervalue people. if you're going to, I just don't think there is enough thought given to the human cost of things. Even in the sentence about these boys that they're going to send to war, how deeply did you think about the human cost of the boys that you're, right, sending? And it made me think now, with immigration issues, people talk so casually, but a lot of people are fleeing because they are afraid that their child will have to fight in a fight that, one, seems meaningless to them. It probably is. And two, mm-hmm, that person means so much to them. There's a point where in Persepolis where they say, like, oh, you know, a martyr gives up their lives to, like, as a blood, like, as a blood source for the country, like, to keep the country alive. And she's critical of that. And it's the same thought, like, you want me to take this precious person who you outside do not see the value of and give them to you. Mm. And you're not even doing the cost benefit analysis. You have not thought about their value enough to make that decision. Mm-hmm. It's a gluttony, you know, it's an entitlement. And that's what I mean. Like, and I love this memoir because everyone in this book is human, the way she writes it. Mm-hmm. And so the value of a person is far more accurately assessed. And that value, yeah, is that people are priceless. That's what it is. That's the answer at the, right, end of this.
Yeah. And that's just, oof. Just so beautifully said, because it's like, yeah, at the end of the day, it's like we fetishize this martyrdom, right? But then it's like, they die, and then what? You just replace them with someone else just to, like, keep going with whatever political game is taking place, or, like, whatever political power we're trying to attain here. You know, it just seems so, like, backed by institutions that we made up ourselves that, like, are completely, completely constructed by us, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, it just seems so absurd. Like, it's just, like, you read the shit that is going on here, and you're like, but what exactly... Why is this, yes, happening? And again, Persepolis 2, y'all gotta read it. Like, I feel like Margie's parents talk about this a lot, especially her dad being like, yeah, like, for what, girl?
For,
like,
what?
We did all that. All these people died. For what?
And in 1988,
for what?
Even the Iraq-Iran war ends in a stalemate, guys. It ends in a stalemate. Yeah. How painful is that?
Yeah.
And I think what's also beautiful about this story is that by mentioning these people, you know, I would not have known anything about Mohsen. Yeah, Mohsen. I wouldn't have known anything, mm-hmm, about Anoush. She keeps them alive. And in a way, she, yeah, shows, you know, at first, her childish heroicism is like a little bit, like, you know, Margie's like, oh, yeah, you know, the revolution. Everyone should be a part of the revolution. You know, she has this, like, almost superhero, yeah, like, Batman-esque feeling. And that goes back to the point of imagination, right? We make heroes and superheroes out of, you know, what we have. And now we have comics. And back then you had, you know, revolutionaries. But mm-hmm, but by putting them in this book, she shows, like, the heroicism of everyday people. And that's what those are the heroes in the story. Her uncle Anoush, that beauty, please read that scene. Like, between the two of them is so warm. And even when, and that's when Mohsin and I think it's
Samak?
Yeah, Samak. When Mohsin and Samak come over and they're so vibrant and alive and laughing and hugging each other and there's love between them, even though they've been through something awful and will actually go through something awful again. That's mm-hmm. that's the she so beautifully illustrates, you know, the beauty of people and the familiarity of them. And I love that. And the way she draws too, mm-hmm. she takes a lot of metaphoric words and puts them into pictographs, and it's really, really well done. And then I think there's a scene that really stuck with me where it's like the Shah, she was like, the Shah's empire was almost over. And behind it is a bunch of like, almost like zombie dead bodies, because he's like killed mm-hmm. a bunch of people, and the people are getting more and more resistant and intolerant to his behavior. And it's, but mm-hmm. the picture of it is so much more expressive, you know, than just reading it. Mm-hmm. It sticks with you.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And it's just, I loved the art style. I thought it was so, it was just, I don't even know, I'm trying to look for the words for it. It was just like, almost like, I don't want to say minimalist, but like, there was a, I feel like in going through these extreme, like these very complex like ideas and concepts and histories, like it was just, there was like a simplicity to the drawing style that was just very like approachable and fun. Like, yeah. It's a really, really small detail, but like, I loved how like, Margie's dad, for example, like in most of the panels that had him, rather than having a mouth, it just had his mustache. It's like something about that was just so like fun, especially when you would see the different ways he would emote, but like you didn't actually see his lips. I don't know, it was just like these very like cute things, like these cute details that just had like a I don't know, like it just yeah, going back to that humanity, going back to that, just like there's a perseverance to still live life and to still enjoy your life and to still like, yeah, just like move through in the way that like is the most authentic for you, that I just really appreciate. That was like somehow reflected in the drawing. People might be like, girl, that's a reach.
No, it's not. It's not.
Listen, that is my interpretation.
It was there.
Yon go say that shit to me.
Well, that's why comics.
So, yeah.
That's why comics is an art form, right? Because she, as an artist, was able to portray that silliness and that you know, fun of life in the art as well as in the wording and the panels. Mm. And that's the art of it, right? That's the literary merit of comics, by the way, high school teacher, right? Is that she was able to express the tone and the texture in a way that really stuck with you and that enhanced the words on the page.
Great. So, yeah, I was living for the art style. I thought it was just like, yeah, there were definitely some panels I'm like, this is actually just like actually hilarious. Like, what the fuck?
Yes.
Yeah. So it was just a very, it was just deeply expressive.
Yes.
And I think, and especially in talking about a time period where expression was just so limited and like so actively like squashed. So, like, it's just, it's really interesting to kind of see a retelling of that from mm-hmm. like that kind of lens and framework. So,
and not just that, in the year it was written, 2002, there was also the squashing of the Middle East. I'll say from the Western perspective, there was a squashing of the Middle East mm-hmm. as one type of thing. And so this book pushes so hard against that by expanding. And just to be honest, just being honest, right? That's what a memoir is, just an honest retelling. But it pushes hard against that flattening in and of itself, because it's like, here are complex people. You're trying to make something nuanced flat. And by just showing you mm-hmm. my life as it is, I am explaining to you that what you've said is flat, is actually triple, quadruply dimensional, multidimensional. That's the word mm-hmm. she was looking for. And I think that's what people mean when they say to live is revolutionary. They don't just mean that like you being alive is revolutionary, which it is, but in the sense that like by just living, the flattening we do is made ridiculous. By just living, no one can say that you did not exist, that you were not real, because you are.
Right.
By just living her life, it counteracts most of the early 2000 stereotypes about the Middle East. And she, by encapsulating it in a story, she makes it last longer you know, than just even her life. And like I said, she extends extends the existence. It's kind of weird, but like she won't even let you erase the people who were killed in an untimely manner. You know what I mean?
Mm,
I guess you're always killed in an untimely manner, but she gives life to people. She brings them back into the consciousness, and she forces us to recognize them and their nuance.
Right.
And a lot of times, you know, some of the people are annoying. Some of the people who die are annoying. And even that is rebellious because, right, like, it's humanizing. They're people. Then no one said people were saints. But that's not what makes us valuable, is that we're like, it's only tragic if we're saints and we die. No, sometimes someone you really dislike is in these situations, and it doesn't make them any less human. In fact, it makes us more human.
Right.
So I really like that she did that, too. I really like that she let them... The characters just be people. They were just people. And that's glorious and heroic. I also...
Because that's like... Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, because that's almost like another form of like dehumanization, where we like try to make it seem like people somehow aren't people, or that like you know, people aren't multifaceted.
Right.
And I think that's something that we do a lot in history, where we kind of like remove those layers. And so I think, I'm just a grand girl.
I also think it makes us feel like we don't have, like, a martyr becomes someone else, and it doesn't have to be you.
Yeah.
And so if you don't rise to the occasion, you don't have to, because that martyr was so, you know, I think about this a lot with MLK, like the way people make it seem like this guy was like the second coming of Jesus. I was like, this is a person. And if everyone in America had acted, or I guess what I'm saying is, instead of making martyrs, why don't we all just do better? Instead of putting it on like five people to change a whole country and having them lose their lives in the process, why not you be a little strong too? Like, all of us take the burden into ourselves and stand together. And then, and honestly, there's a little scene of this with the kids when, like, in the story where, like, the teachers are, like, arguing with them about something, and all the kids are like, no, we actually don't care about this. And they all get expelled, right? And if one person had done it, you know, that's easy to dismiss or get rid of that one person. But all of us in unity have a better chance. And I think it's harder when you scale that up, obviously, because the amount of people who get killed in the story is very high.
Yeah.
But I also wanted to, the reason I told this whole historical context of Persia starting up from 1518 BCE wasn't just because I'm a history nerd and I love history, which I do, but I also, and this was her point in the story, in the preamble, where she was like, this is a very, very old culture, and it's made of so many things, not just this one moment in time of upheaval. And I feel the same way with the death of Vivek Oji. You know, we are in a certain time now, but we are so much, all these countries that people tend to think of a certain way, are one so much older than that, and our culture is not made up of revolutions and violence, you know. So
honestly, I mean, there's not much else I had to say. I just I heavy fucked with this memoir. I thought it was deeply educational, and honestly, I'm just like, I just want to just read more memoirs and just, like, like, really make this part of, like, my reading practice. Because I'm like, wow, I've really been sleeping on this genre. And, like, there's just, like, a lot of great stories to be told. A lot of great, like, just personal narratives and histories and just, like, things like that. Like, I would love to have... Because, like, I just learned so much about the Islamic Revolution from reading this in a way that I was like, I would love to kind of, like, use, like, story and narrative and, like, you know, things like that to kind of learn about just other parts of... just like history and just like what predates us, you know what I mean? And really trying to break out of that, like, I don't know, this like U.S. paradigm of like, this is the only history you need to know, like, fuck everything else. And it's like, but girl, there's like so much. It's like a lot.
I think that's beautiful, Marcy. I think history is the type of thing that the more you know about it, the less you can be deceived by propaganda, I think, and just in general, because people become more complex. You know, the more you learn about people and their culture, it's harder to be told that someone isn't human, you know? And that's and that's what oppressive forces do throughout history. I mean, look at Nazi Germany. Like, that's a quintessential example that's easy to point to. Once you dehumanize people, it's easy to harm them. And the stories and personal narratives and, you know, go a long way in not allowing you to do that. Yeah, I just wanted to say one thing on the Persepolis, too, that I really, and I didn't read it the second time because I didn't, because it's a summer short, because I'm messing around. Remember with Mealbone, we just, like, didn't read the last act. Anyway,
we just didn't.
We just didn't read it. We're like, this is a book club podcast. Anyway, but I think, and you pointed to this as well, there was not, it's not just this being in the country when it happens. That's part of the story, but that second part of asylum, of being somewhere else, and the pain of being somewhere where no one is experiencing any of the harm that you've been through, and having home, feeling like you have no home. I really wish people would sympathize with that when it comes to people seeking asylum or just running.
Yeah.
Is that that's a melancholy that people carry with them, and it's passed down generationally. And so that part in the second book really stuck with me, that feeling of not being home and not having a home to go back to. And when people flee, think about that. It's not just they're giving up a lot. And so whatever is they're fleeing from has to be bad. I have nothing else to add to this story. I'm trying to think if I know anything. Anyway, this is a really good book, and it's definitely
just read y'all. Just read it, please. It's so good. It's just so. I highly recommend, just the complete Persepolis, just get all the books, just combine, it's just so good. It's so good.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Well, so, I mean, if you're like, Akko, you really did a wonderful job with that cultural context. However, you made a couple of mistakes. I am here for it, and I think that you should definitely tell me. And you can do that at The Color Pages on our Twitter, or at These Color Pages on Instagram. Also, you can see what else we're reading. I think this might be the heaviest book we read, but I haven't read the other ones, so I couldn't tell you. Well, you can see what else we're reading in the Summer Sword series, which is usually light and fluffy. And then if you're like, wow, you guys are not being light and fluffy right now, you know, we got an email, thesecolorpages@gmail.com. You know, let us know. We also have a website, thesecolorpages.com. So you can go there. And yeah, just, you know, anything you want to tell us, let us know.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And yeah, in our description as well for this episode, you'll find our link tree. So if you want to see what else we're reading over the summer, you can find it all there. And also too, if this show brought you any love, light, delight, and you want to share this with any of your friends, like, please do that. We definitely appreciate you forwarding, you know, this along to just any of your friends who might appreciate this episode. Also, too, wherever you're, you know, if you really enjoyed this episode and, like, want to leave us some love wherever you're listening to this podcast, we also deeply appreciate that as well. Mm-hmm. It could be Apple Podcasts or not. Either way, totally fine. We love to see it regardless. Yeah, and we just want to thank you all again for just, like, listening, tuning in, and just, like, being part of this journey with us. So our next... I'm not going to call it a book because it's not, but the next thing we're going to be talking about is actually going to be The Wiz.
Woo!
That's right, y'all. We're talking about the 1978 American musical adventure featuring Diana Ross and a whole crew of just like Motown legends. So we'll be talking about that in our next episode. We might actually have some special guests to balance it back and forth with. So just, you know. Keep abreast on that because, yeah, that should be a really, really fun episode. We're very, very, very excited to talk about The Wiz. But between now and then, Akko, is there anything else we should leave our listeners with before we head out?
No, just until we see you next time. Honestly and truly, remember to
stay colorful.